Now, in our theme today, the 12th month and the 12th theme, we're going to cover the following. Jesus, as a preacher, he instructs Judas, his esteem for John, and his visit to Bethlehem, and there he shares the mystery of his birth with his disciples. And we may add another chapter because I needed more material. It didn't seem that I had enough for today. First, the chapter 68, we call it a chapter. Jesus preaches in the temple, and Judas Iscariot was with him. In the scene, we have Jesus entering the temple enclosure, and he asks Judas to call the official to ask permission to teach. At this point, Judas is saying, "You have to ask permission? You don't need permission." And Jesus says, "No, I didn't come here to rebel against the law. I came here to obey, to set an example." And now prior to that, though, this is what kind of induced Judas to say that. We had the scene with the money changers. Jesus took over. He just didn't ask. He took cores and he beat them mercilessly, turned over the tables, didn't ask anybody. So Judas, thinking of that event, was saying, "Well, Lord, you don't have to ask anybody." And so Jesus corrected that. And he says that the master is above the temple, was Judas' way of saying it, that he has come to, but Jesus has come to teach respect, humility, and obedience, and to remove scandal. So the official arrives on the scene, and he asks, "Are you a rabbi?" Now, I'm picking up the conversation on page 351, if you have the first volume, the middle of the page. And Jesus' response is, "Yes, I am." "And who is your teacher?" And Jesus says, "The Spirit of God, who speaks to me in his wisdom and enlightens for me every word of the Holy Scriptures. Are you greater than Hillel?" See, there were three of them that were outstanding, and one of them was Hillel. "Are you greater than Hillel, since you say you know all the doctrines without a teacher? How can one be formed if there is no one forming him?" And Jesus' response was, "As David was formed, an unknown little shepherd, who became a powerful and wise king by God's will. Your name, Jesus of Joseph, of Jacob, of the house of David, and of Mary, of Joachim, of the house of David, and of Anne, of Aaron, Mary, the virgin married in the temple by the high priest, according to the law of Israel, because she was an orphan." And who can prove that? There must be still some Levites here who will remember the event and who were the same age as Zacharias of the class of Abia, my relative. Ask them if you doubt my sincerity. I believe you, but who will prove to me that you are capable of teaching? Well, listen to me, and you will judge by yourself. You're free to do it. And so we get back to our description again. So Jesus, at this point, he preaches on the love of God, and he doesn't quite begin yet, but he begins the conversation with Judas here, and this is on page 352, and Judas asks, "Why did you not say that you are the Messiah? My words will say so. Which is the sign to be fulfilled?" Judas says, "Jesus, the union of Israel under the teaching of the word of Christ. I am the shepherd of whom the prophets speak, and I have come to gather all the sheep of every region. I have come to cure the sick ones, put the wandering ones in a good pasture. There is no Judea or Galilee, no Decapolis or Idumea for me. There is only one thing, the love that sees with one glance only and joins in one embrace only in order to save." Jesus looks inspired. In other words, he's especially under the power of the Spirit. Rays of light seem to be emanating from him so happily he smiles at his dream. And Judas is amazed and he simply stares at the Lord out of respect and amazement. Now, after preaching on the love of God, this is what Jesus says on page 353, some of the message that he delivered to the people. And he says, I say to you, love also those who offend you. Do not consider that Adam and every man through him is a sinner against God, and there is no one who can say, I have not offended God. And yet, God forgives, not once only. He forgives dozens of times. He forgives thousands of times, as it is proved by the fact that men still exist on earth. He's saying, if God didn't forgive, this earth would have been destroyed. Forgive, therefore, as God forgives. And if you cannot do it out of love for the brother who injures you, do it for the love of God, who gives you bread and life, who protects you in your worldly needs, and has arranged all events to procure eternal peace for you in his bosom. This is the new law, the law of God's springtime, of the flowery time of grace amongst men, of the time that will bear you a matchless fruit that will open the gates of heaven for you. At this point, then, Jesus speaks about John the Baptist as the one who announced the coming of the Messiah, who is now among them. He also praises John in these words, among the children of Abraham, there is no one greater in grace than he, John the Baptist. Judas then declares that Jesus is the Messiah, and the people back off frightened, but are reassured by Jesus' smile, and he then performs a miracle by restoring the sight of a blind man. In other words, as the proof that he is the Messiah. And here we pick up the conversation from the Levite now, who saw the miracle, and on page 354, the bottom of the page. A Levite who arrived towards the end of the miracle asks, on what authority do you do such things? Are you asking me? I will tell you, if you answer a question. According to you, who is greater, a prophet who prophesies the Messiah or the Messiah himself? And the Levite says, what a question. The Messiah is greater. He's the Redeemer, promised by the Most High. And Jesus says, well then, why did the prophets work miracles and what authority? And he says, on the authority given them by God to prove to the crowds that God was with him. Well, Jesus says, I work miracles on the same authority. God is with me. I am with him. And I thus prove to the people that what I say is true, and that the Messiah, with a greater right and a greater power, can do what the prophets were able to do. So the Levite thinks about that, and he walks away. And so that ends the scene on this particular chapter. Before we move on, any question on this so far? All right, the next chapter there, Jesus teaches Judas. All through these five volumes, this is another proof, and there are many ways in which you have to say, this woman could not have written this. This was revealed to her. How could she have responded to Judas in all the intricate ways in which the dialogue goes on here? And it shows you, in other words, how the spirit of evil used Judas also to tempt Jesus at different times. And so the conversation here is very revealing. Yes?
Now, this last statement you made, well, why did the prophets work miracles? Now, these prophets he's referring to are from the Old Testament.
Yes, of course.
Because when Jesus came...
See, the New Testament began with Jesus. Anything before that is Old Testament.
Yeah, they were performing prophets.
Elijah, Moses,
miracles,
you know,
yes.
Moses.
Okay.
If I may put a little joke in here,
sure.
There's a new one about Moses crossing the Red Sea. It has Moses with all the Israelites standing on the shore looking out there. You know, what are we going to do? So Moses calls up his press agent, Sam. And he says, Sam, where are the boats? And Sam says, oh, my goodness. I was so busy with the press releases, Moses, and I forgot about it. And Moses said, you idiot. What do you expect me to do? Stretch my rod over the water and part the waters? And Sam said, gee, Moses, if you can do that, I'll get you 2 pages in the New Testament, in the Old Testament. Well, be that as it may. So now Jesus leaves the temple with Judas and now wishes to pray, but Judas wants to stay with him. Here again you see how the Lord sometimes doesn't want anyone with him. In this case, especially Judas. See, he sees that Judas is not true blue. There's his character is so devious. We pick up the scene here. It's the second chapter, paragraph, under that chapter. Judas would like to remain with Jesus, but the master objects to his wish. Jesus said, Judas, I want to be alone at night time. At night, my spirit gets its nourishment from the Father. Here's an insight into Jesus. See? Why did he spend so much time at night praying? Nourishment from the Father. Keep in mind that he's God. In the Trinity, there was a glorious, intercommunion that you can't put into words, and he missed that. It tells you that in the body, he was so confined to, in a certain sense, and distracted from being obligated to walk this earth, he missed that presence, but yet it was with him. This is a mystery. How could that be when you had both together? Jesus, Son of God and man. He's a mystery. But here's he saying something about this. He said, my spirit gets its nourishment from the Father. Prayer, meditation, and solitude are more necessary for me than material food. Didn't he say, my food is to do the will of my Father? Whoever wishes to live for the Spirit and lead others to live the same life must disregard the flesh. Yes, I would say kill it, to devote all his attention to the Spirit. Everybody must do that, you know, Judas. You too, if you really want to belong to God, that is, to the supernatural. He's constantly ministering to that element in Judas that will eventually betray him. See? Trying to change him, trying to correct his evil inclinations. Now, he's using a word that is very drastic. He doesn't actually mean to kill yourself. That would be suicide. See? But what he means is self-control, discipline, mortification. It's a good word. It means to put to death those desires within us. It means get them out of us. Detach ourselves from them. So before leaving Judas, Jesus teaches him a lesson in self-denial, and Judas asks what he must leave, and Jesus replies, everything that upsets you. He goes on to tell Judas that those who take their life out of despair are guilty of pride. Now here's something that we need to explain, and we're going to pick up the conversation here on page 356. It's the middle of the page. And Jesus asked Judas, and they were talking about, in other words, how despair also is a part of pride. As Jesus says, and what is despair but pride? Just think, Judas, why does one despair? Either because misfortunes persistently disturb him and he wants to overcome them by himself but is unable to do so, or because he is guilty and he thinks that he cannot be forgiven by God. In both cases, is not pride the basic reason? The man who wants to do all by himself is no longer humble enough to stretch out his hand to the Father and say, I am not able, but you are. Help me because I hope and wait for everything from you. Perfectly true. Now, when Jesus speaks about our need to practice self-control as a means to bring us to eternal happiness, he stresses control of, quote, the flesh in all its lusts, and he emphasizes all of them. Control of the mind and all its desires, and he says all of them. And control of the heart and the human passions. Now, he doesn't mean to eliminate them all. Control. See, control means they're there. You cannot destroy your appetites. They're there for a good reason. So the need for food, for sleep, sexual needs, and so forth, that cannot be destroyed, but controlled. See? So he's not saying, therefore, that it should be destroyed. No, controlled. Now, Judas says that it's difficult to do so, and he adds, I am a man young and full of life. And Jesus then says that he too has real flesh, so that through the experience of the flesh, I might learn which are the temptations of man. Now, here we have an interesting dialogue that we're going to explore. So Judas then asks, and what about sins? So on page 358, we pick up their dialogue here. And Jesus says, middle of the page, everyone can be tempted. Sinners are only those who want to be sinners. And then he asked Jesus, have you ever sinned, Jesus? And Jesus says, no. I never wanted. See, he emphasizes the word never. I never wanted to sin. But he says, not because I am the Son of the Father, but because I wanted not to sin. And I want to prove to man that the Son of Man did not sin because he did not want to sin. And that man can, if he wants to, not sin. Again, he's bombarding Judas, see, who had many vices. So he continues. Another question here. See, this is very important insights into Jesus, too. Judas says, have you ever been tempted? And Jesus says, I am 30 years old, Judas, and I did not live in a cave. Upon a mountain. I lived amongst men. And if I had been in the loneliest place in the world, do you think temptations would not have come to me? Remember the 40 days in the desert and the temptations. We have everything in us, good and evil. But by the way, now, when we talk about Jesus saying good and evil, be careful. At the bottom of the page here, you have an explanation. We have everything in us, good and evil. It cannot be referred also to Jesus, but only to Judas and all the members of mankind, in other words, the rest of the human race, stained by original sin. Jesus' short speech aims at convincing Judas that man, if he wants and asks God for help, can overcome all trials and temptations. So let's go back to the conversation then. We carry everything within us, and the breath of God blows on the good and revives it like a thurible. You know what that is? A censer, in which they use a benediction to sense the incense, the Blessed Sacrament. A thurible of sweet-smelling holy incense. And Satan blows on evil, thus kindling a furious blazing fire. But diligent goodwill, constant prayer, are like a damp sand on the hellish fire. They suffocate it and put it out. Well, in other words, it's like anyone that is tempted, and we've covered this in many of our conferences over these past 12 years or more. Take anger. You're tempted to anger. Now, what's feeding the anger? Well, it's maybe somebody right in front of you. Or just maybe the thought of somebody. If you absent yourself from that for a moment, in other words, just turn to Jesus, close your eyes and say, Lord, please be with me, I need you. What's feeding the anger? Nothing. See? You forgot the image or the thought, but you're with the Lord. See? And this is what he's saying here. It's like a damp sand. It's a good image of what it does to the fire that's blazing within us of anger. It subsides. Now, regarding the other temptations that Jesus talked about, not only did Judas ask if you were tempted, he said, page 359, and have you ever yielded? See, granted that Jesus is tempted, he's saying, have you ever consented? And Jesus says, no, never. How did you manage? And Jesus says, Father, Jesus said, I say, Father, lead me not into temptation. Judas is surprised. He says, what? You, the Messiah? You work miracles and you ask your Father for help? And Jesus says, not only for help, I ask him not to lead me into temptation. Do you think that I, simply because I am who I am, there's a mistake in print there, and I have to correct that. Because I am who I am, namely God, can do without the Father? Oh no. I solemnly tell you that the Father grants everything to his Son, and that the Son receives everything from the Father. And I tell you that everything the Father will be asked for in my name will be granted. You remember that in John, whatever you ask in my name, I will give it to you. And here it is in another context. And with that, now we move on into the next chapter. Jesus meets John of Zebedee. That's John's name. He's the one that's 19 years old, and he's the favorite of Jesus. So whenever you meet John of Zebedee, this is the one that Jesus loved. And he meets him at Gethsemane. The scene here is the meeting between John of Zebedee and John of Zebedee and Jesus is very joyful and affectionate. John is running down a hill toward the town when Jesus calls him, and John shouts with joy, "Oh, my master!" And he runs toward him, and Jesus receives him with wide open arms, and they embrace each other affectionately. As they walk, Jesus places an arm on John's shoulders, who is very happy for so much intimacy. Both of them go to a small house in the Garden of Gethsemane and eat a meal of food that John brought, prepared by our Blessed Lady. After the meal, they go out into the garden and talk. They look at the top of the temple, and Jesus says, here again, it tells you what he already knew, and it became more clear with time what was happening in the temple. Jesus says, the angels have abandoned the temple, because he says, not even one-tenth of the priests and the Levites living there are capable of giving life to the holy place. Remember, prior to this, they had turned the temple into a black supermarket. And he chased them all out. He said, my house is not a den of thieves, it's a house of prayer. And now he's explaining here. He said, they give death instead, the death of their own souls. John is concerned that Jesus will get tired traveling on foot so much, but Jesus says, I don't get tired. I'll walk so much, I'll never tire. What makes me tired is indifference. Again, remember all the time that we're dealing with God in the form of a human form, so that his desires are beyond anything that we can imagine. So what pleased him most was to be listened to and to be loved. It's like a weight, he says, on your heart. They also talk about the other disciples, including Judas. And Jesus points out that they all have different characters, which is in their favor, because in that way they form a perfect union, complementing each other. And they're to work for the cause of God and out of love for his Christ. About John, Jesus says that he is the loving peace of the Christ. In other words, John was Jesus' joy. And he makes a comparison between John and Judas. And this is on page 365 that we pick up this character evaluation at the bottom of the page. About John, he says, "He is the one who divests himself also of his own way of thinking and judging in order to be the disciple. He is the one who gives himself without wishing to withhold even a particle of himself, as his self was before becoming a disciple. Judas is the one who does not want to divest himself of himself. His donation is therefore unreal. He carries within himself his ego diseased," now notice this, "with pride, sensuality, greed." He thought Jesus would be a material king, and he would be a prince, and therefore he would just roll in wealth. Judas retains his way of thinking, and he thus counteracts the effects of the donation and of grace. In other words, the very presence of Jesus with him had no effect on him. I shouldn't say no effect. He had conversions, but they were partial, and he fell back into his old ways again. And all through the 3 years that they were together, he left the apostles at different times. He went out on the town, we would say today, went out on the town. And he comes back, and Jesus waiting for him all night, praying for him. And he revealed everything he did that night. And after all that, Judas repents, but after a while, he goes back to his old ways. So it's a sad story. And we have to think, in other words, with all the help that he had, he was still lost. There's no doubt about that. Jesus said he is lost. He is lost. In the fifth volume, we're told that he appeared to Judas's mother after the resurrection to comfort her, because the people who loved Jesus and knew that it was Judas who betrayed were then insulting his mother, and she was just dying with shame and grief. And Jesus comforted her, and by that appearance, and said she was not to blame. But he didn't say Judas was saved. Oh. See, he did not say that.
Is that like the choice that Judas made?
He said Judas, yes, used his will in a wrong way. He made a bad choice. He chose his destiny. See. That's something that we have to keep in mind. Any other question? Now, these are different aspects that are worth covering, because, in other words, there's more to this than you have in the gospel. All you have is different incidents, very short, where Judas was a thief, where he said different things when the donation was made of the nard with which Mary Magdalene bathed Jesus' feet. He said, "Why do this? Why can't we sell this?" And John says in the gospel, he said this because he was a thief. He wanted to take the money. Now let's move on to the next chapter then, on page 366. Jesus with Judas Iscariot meet Simon Zealot and John. Jesus and Judas are talking within the enclosure of one of the gates of the temple. And Jesus is trying to get Judas to share his inner thoughts with him. Here again, notice, all the time that they're together, Jesus is constantly ministering to him to change him. And how Judas is open, but he's not completely open, devious, and yet Jesus bears with him. He tries to get Judas to kind of open up. He tells Judas that he wants sincerity and trust from his disciples. It took Judas a long time, and maybe it never really dawned on him that Jesus read his thoughts all the time. See? He couldn't say a thing that Jesus didn't know he was going to say it already. He urges Judas to trust him like he did his own father, whom he loved dearly. This is background knowledge Jesus knew his entire life. He knew as a child that Judas loved his father. And he's trying to work on him psychologically to reveal himself to Jesus, consider Jesus as a father image. So Judas promises in these words, he says, "If you love me so much, I will strive to be good as you want." And Jesus says, "I will love you as no other man could possibly love you. Do not disappoint me." So now they meet John and Simon Zealot. That's another disciple. And both Simon and Judas invite Jesus to come and visit their hometown. And then Jesus asks Simon Zealot to be more patient with Judas than the other disciples will be. Here again, notice how Jesus is preparing the future apostles on how to deal with Judas. He conceals the ultimate event, the betrayal, because he does say in the fifth volume, if they knew what Judas was going to do, they would have killed him, and therefore they would have been guilty of a crime. See? And so in different ways, but he's also trying to smooth the way for them to first of all accept him, Judas, and to give him consideration, because he was just a bad egg. We're going to move on to the next chapter. Jesus, John, Simon, and Judas go to Bethlehem. Now, there's the same gate of the temple, and he invites them to go with him through Judea. Jesus promises to grant them the power to preach in his name and to work miracles in his name also. And Judas says, now here again, with this promise, here you can see how Judas sees how he would use that power. And he says, how they're going to admire us then. See, we're going to be big shots. Or like I said earlier this morning, that German nun said, we're going to be high shots. And he's overjoyed at the thought. But the other disciple, Simon Zealot, cautioned Judas about the effect of pride and human ambitions on their ministry for Jesus. And Jesus now tells the disciples that they're going to Bethlehem. There they will learn about the Messiah and the scriptures and how the prophecies were fulfilled there. Again, too, this is not in the gospel that Jesus returned to Bethlehem several times. And he returned there once with Our Lady, and at that time he also explained what Our Lady went through. This is a glorious revelation of what happened at the time of Our Lady's, the birth of Jesus, and how Our Lady was just, you know, in an ecstasy of joy that not even the saints could ever appreciate. And these two are insights about these events, you know, the Christmas event. We're going to cover some of this later on. But before we do, any question? Well, let us take the next chapter then. Here they're in Bethlehem, in a peasant's house, and also they visit the grotto, namely the cave where Jesus was born. And we're on page 371 and 2, actually 372. At this point now, they're talking with a woman outside of Bethlehem. And Jesus tells her that he was born in Bethlehem, and when she finds out that he's 30 years old, she brings up the subject of the slaughter of the innocents. She curses those who led the people to believe that a Messiah had come. This, again, is not in the gospel, but you see, there are many, what we say, empty spots there, they need to be filled out. That's why this poem. See? In other words, what actually happened to those people after the slaughter of the innocents? How did it affect them? It's devastating. See? She curses the shepherds. But she invites Jesus and his disciples to spend the night at her house. But first, she needs some help with the garden that she's in, so they help her to water the vegetables. During the meal, they talk about the events that happened 30 years ago, and Jesus says that his family ran away when he was a few months old. Notice how he's not revealing who he is yet. So they, in other words, left before the massacre. Now the husband describes the slaughter. He exaggerates the number that were killed, and Maria Del Torta supplies the correct information. This we never knew either. It's not mentioned in the gospel. But actually, 18 babies were killed in Bethlehem, and 14 in a nearby countryside. By mistake, 6 baby girls were also killed because, well, they were babies who were dressed alike. And he talks about the shepherds that convinced him that the Messiah was born and how he and the whole town believed it. So we'll pick up the dialogue here on page 375, the last part of the page. And he answers why, in other words, they were deceived. He says, because a group of shepherds who had obviously drank a huge quantity of cider to stand the intense night cold in a frenzy of excitement stated that they had seen angels, heard songs, received instructions. And they said to us in Bethlehem, come, adore the Messiah, he's born. Just imagine the Messiah in a cave. In all sincerity, I must admit that we were all drunk, even I, then an adolescent, also my wife, then only a few years old, because we all believed them. And in a poor Galilean woman, he's talking about Mary, we saw the Virgin Mother mentioned by the prophets. But she was with her husband, a rough Galilean. And if she was the wife, how could she be the virgin? To cut a long story short, he says, we believed. Gifts, worshiping, houses open to give them hospitality. They played their roles very well. And poor Anne, that was the lady who took them in out of the cave after several days. She lost her property and her life, and also the children of her oldest daughter, the only one left because she was married to a merchant in Jerusalem, lost all their property because their house was burned down and the whole holding was laid waste by Herod's order. Now it's an uncultivated field where herds feed. And was it entirely the shepherd's fault? I believe this is Jesus asking that question. And he says, no, it was the fault also of 3 wizards, he means the wise men, who came from Satan's kingdom. Perhaps they were accomplices of the 3, and we foolishly felt proud of so much honor. And the poor arch synagogue, we killed him because he swore that the prophecies confirmed the truth of the shepherds and the wizards' words. So there you see, in other words, the disaster that followed and how the whole town was devastated. And we'll pick up some of this in this kind of description here. After this, he curses the shepherds and the magicians, and he, as he calls them, magicians, instead of the 3 wise men. And Jesus corrects him and he says, one curse attracts another. The law of love forbids cursing. And then he quotes the prophecies of the Old Testament to prove that the events at his birth in Bethlehem were a fulfillment of those prophecies. And he asks about the shepherds, and he's told that they're still alive and working for a wealthy landowner. The husband now expresses great hatred for them. He said, we would kill them even now if we were not afraid of their master. In other words, they were working for a landowner. And again, Jesus corrects them. And this is page 377, the bottom of the page. I tell you, do not hate. Do not wish evil things. Do not be anxious to do evil things. There's no fault here. But even if there was, forgive. forgive in the name of God. Tell the other people of Bethlehem as well. When your hearts are free from hatred, the Messiah will come. And you will know him then because he is alive. He already existed when the massacre took place. I am telling you, it was Satan's fault, not the fault of the shepherds and of the magi, or he uses their word, the magicians, that the massacre took place. The Messiah was born here for you. He came to bring the light to the land of his fathers. The son of a virgin mother of the line of David, in the ruins of the house of David, he granted a stream of graces to the world and a new life to mankind. Go away, the man says. Get out of here. You are a follower of that false Messiah, who could but be false because he brought misfortune to us here in Bethlehem, and you're defending him? And he says, be silent, man, Jesus says. Excuse me, this is Judas. I am a Judean, and I have influential friends. I can make you feel sorry for your insult, burst out Judas, getting hold of the peasant's garments and shaking him in a fit of violent anger. But the man insists, no, out of here. I don't want trouble with the people of Bethlehem or with Rome or Herod. Go away, you cursed ones, if you don't want me to leave my mark on you. So in other words, he threatens violence. After this angry exchange, Jesus invites them to come to the cave where he was born. As they enter the cave, Judas exclaims, you must be joking, Master. This is a filthy den. I'm not going to stay here. I loathe it. It's a damp, cold, stinking place full of scorpions and perhaps also snakes. And Jesus replies, no, Judas, do not avert your eyes in disgust. Do not lift with disgust your beautiful embroidered mantle, lest it may trail on the ground covered with animal excrement. And we pick up the dialogue in 380 here. This ground, you may tread on it without disdain. It is littered with excrement, but it is sanctified by her foot, the foot of the holy, the most holy, pure, immaculate Mother of God, who gave birth because she was to give birth because God, not man, told her and covered her with his shadow. She, the faultless one, trod on it. You can tread on it too. And may the purity diffused by her, by the will of God, rise from the soles of your feet to your heart. Again, he's appealing to Judas' better nature. Simon Zealot is on his knees. John goes straight to the manger and cries, leaning his head against it. Judas is terrified. Notice the contrast in the different disciples. And always Judas always takes a negative, well, not always, but usually takes a negative approach. John is overcome. Judas is terrified, but he's also overcome by emotion and no longer worried about his beautiful mantle. He kneels on the ground, takes the edge of Jesus' tunic and kisses it and beats his breast saying, O my good master, have mercy on the blindness of your servant. My pride vanishes. I see you as you are, not the king I was thinking of, but the eternal prince, the father of future centuries, the king of peace. Have mercy, my Lord and my God. Have mercy on me. Well, today, Bethlehem and the crib and the place, do we actually have the same place? We don't. I was there twice. They built a beautiful basilica there, the Franciscans. And they have a spot they call it the cave, and it's in a lower level of the basilica. But over the what? How many centuries? 2,000 years. Do we have the same exact spot? What has happened? There have been wars. There have been all kinds of devastation. And now we were told when we walked the streets of Jerusalem, we were 25 feet above where Jesus actually walked. So you're not really walking in his actual footsteps, except in one place.